Thank you. Thank you very much, James. President Brady, Professor Fogarty. Let me say what a pleasure it is to be here, and I would very much like to express, as I've perhaps expressed before, the fact that I'm sure Professor Brady's tenure as president of this college will be remembered for a great many things. But the fact that in his consulate, so to speak, for the first time, a devoted unit studying the works of James Joyce was established is an excellent thing. And one thing, something which it is astonishing, was outstanding for so very long, and is headed up by the distinguished scholar Anne Fogarty here, who, together with Dr. Luca Crispi, the high priest of genetic criticism, as applied to Joyce, has set up something else which is outstanding for a great many years, for no particular reason, a journal, an Irish journal, devoted to James Joyce. There was a journal devoted to James Joyce in Nebraska, but not in Ireland. And rumours that it was only set up in UCD out of fears that Trinity might do it otherwise are, of course, quite without foundation. Now, it's a great pleasure to be asked to address this distinguished gathering on the topic of Miles de Coppelien and the courts, because, of course, it was under the persona of Miles de Coppelien that most of the writing on that topic took place. The courts feature quite a bit, if rather oddly, in O'Nolan's journalism, notably in the form of what he called the Cruiskeen Court of Voluntary Jurisdiction, of which more later, and the District Court. He loved writing make-up reports of the District Court, which were flattering to no one, as we shall see. But fiction apart, the real District Court featured in Brian O'Nolan's life because he made quite a number of appearances there, involuntarily, on drunken driving charges, being several times acquitted of that heinous offence in so squashbuckling a fashion that in Anthony Cronin's biography, to which Dr. Taff referred, there is actually an apology 40 years after the event for the fact that he was acquitted of drunken driving. This is political correctness, carried to an extreme. Incidentally, when Dr. Taff was speaking, I reflected, of course, Anthony Cronin's biography is a great work, but it's very significant. The first chapter, which is called Brilliant Beginnings, occupies about 2/3 of the book. And there's a certain embarrassment in trying to unpick the later developments, which is accomplished elegantly by Anthony Cronin, though. Now, to continue with O'Nolan's illegal connections, as a civil servant during the war years, he attended as secretary or registrar of the public inquiry conducted by the late Judge Joseph McCarthy into the Cavan Orphanage fire. While he was contemplating this tragic event, he made or renewed, I say probably renewed, the acquaintance of the future Chief Justice Tom O'Higgins, who was also an L&H man in his day, and between them, marooned as they undoubtedly thought of it in Cavan, they conducted, undoubtedly during licensed hours, they concocted a limerick on the tragic event which the inquiry was looking at, which is totally lacking in political correctness and shows no respect for either the cloth or the bench. So you'll understand that I can't share it with you at this time. Now, despite all those connections, O'Nolan, Na Coppelien, Flann O'Brien is not a legal writer in the sense of which James Joyce, Anthony Trollope, and has as recently been very convincingly demonstrated by Dr. Patricia Ferguson from Trinity College, Thomas Hardy are legal writers. There is more law, for example, in Ulysses alone than in O'Nolan's entire output. But when O'Nolan, under the guise of Na Coppelien in the main, turned his attention to the courts, the results could be very striking. Let me share with you one of his ersatz reports of the District Court, which features, I think, one of the best reposts from the dock to the bench that I've ever heard. The writer, who I think of as a bit of a joxer, he writes as follows. In the Dublin District Court yesterday, an elderly man, who gave his name as Miles de Coppoline, was charged with begging, disorderly conduct, using bad language, and being in illegal possession of an armchair. He was also charged with failing to register as an alien. A detective sergeant gave evidence of finding the defendant in the centre of a crowd in Capel Street. He was sitting in the chair, cursing and using bad language. He became offensive when asked to move on and threatened to take on the witness and any 10 butties the witness could find. Defendant was exhibiting a card bearing the words, "Spare a copper, we must all help each other in this cold world." Defendant lay down in the gutter when the witness went to arrest him. He shouted to the crowd to rescue him that he was a Republican soldier. Witness had to send for assistance. Defendant, "Quid immerentes, hospes vexas, canis ignavus, adversum lupos." Detective Sergeant, "The man had no difficulty speaking English when he was lying in the gutter. This sort of thing makes a farce of the language movement." Justice, "If the defendant does not deign to convenience the court, we will have to get an interpreter." Defendant, and this is the riposte, he stares at the justice and he shouts, "I knew your old one." Which I think you must agree must be the most frightening words to hear if you were attempting to adopt a position of dignity and authority. "I knew your old one." Detective Sergeant, "Your worship can see the type of man he is." Defendant, "Yeah," he said, "I remember her well. The few sticks of furniture on the road in 1927, above in Henrietta Street. But I see times have changed. But fortuna non mutat genus," which I think means a sudden access of undeserved good luck doesn't change your lowly origins. Justice, "You would be well advised to behave yourself." Defendant, "You of all people." Justice, "Where did you get this chair?" Detective Sergeant, "Defendant said he got the chair from a man he met in Poole Beg Street. He does not know the man's name. The man was on his way to pawn the chair, and defendant agreed to take it off his hand. He bought the chair." Justice, "For how much?" £45. Justice, "It's a pity it's not a tall boy to be the subject of a tall tale like that." Laughter. Now, O'Nolan first appeared, as the old biographies used to say, meaning first came to public attention, in the UCD, and particularly in the L&H, which used to meet in this room, between 1929 and 1934. Days significant to me, or dates significant to me, because they're exactly 40 years before the time I was involved in both of these institutions. That was the very end of the era when the society met in this room, the old physics theatre, which I think, being a physics theatre, had banked seats somewhere up this way, and the fireplace over there, no doubt hacked at and written on by students, was the very fireplace which James Joyce, for nearly 35 years earlier, had his conversation with the Jesuit about the practical art of fire making. O'Nolan gained a great reputation as a student speaker, able, if I may quote the article in the, say, L&H Centenary History by my old friend and legal colleague Richard Cook, SC. He said he was able to hold the house alternately convulsed with laughter and almost shamefaced with pathos for a full 15 minutes. But his principal fame in the society, as Dr. Taff has said, was as the leader of the mob that used to congregate outside the door there and shout in heckles. According to O'Nolan's own contribution to the L&H Centenary History, he preferred this position, as he puts it, "owing to the necessity to be able to make periodic trips to the Winter Palace at the corner of Harcourt Street, a pub where it was possible to drink 3 or 4 strong pints for 7p. The necessity of which he spoke did not sadly end with his college days. The only change was to the Scotch House off the Quays, did duty for the Winter Palace, when O'Nolan was working in the Customs House. And in that pub, the Scots House, he was introduced to somebody, this is Mr. O'Nolan. He was introduced at about 4 o'clock in the day, at he's a clerk in the Custom House. And the savage interlocutor said, a clerk out of the Custom House, surely. But I'm not here to discuss O'Nolan as a figure in the LNH, though I will say that I wouldn't quite agree with Dr. Taft's characterisation of him as a person who preferred the demotic stance outside the door. He ran for auditor and was in 1932 and was defeated by Vivian de Valera. In that year, the same year, de Valera's father became president of the Executive Council. The same source, as I've already quoted, Dick Cook, described Vivian de Valera in those days, aged about 20, as the most serious-minded man in Ireland. But Dick's own fair-mindedness compelled him to add that it was right to say that he was the most fair-minded as well. It's not fanciful to think that it was in the LNH that O'Nolan made most of his future legal acquaintances, which may have directed his attention in later years to the courts as a subject for his column. He himself records in his contribution to the LNH history that in 1931, Carúl O'Dolly was elected auditor, and he went on to write, "The last time I saw this ex-auditor, he was seated on the bench in the Supreme Court. I have no idea what led O'Nolan to the Supreme Court circa the early 1950s. It's very unlikely that his inebriated episodes ended there, though of course anything is possible." He described the future Chief Justice and President of Ireland in his LNH days as, and I quote, "writing articles in all manner of outside publications, all contentious and all reeking with politics. He was a sort of primitive Miles de Gopoli." His LNH contemporaries included quite a number of people who subsequently became lawyers and some who became county registrars and, more relevantly, district justices. One of these, Dinny O'Donoghue, was still on the bench when I was learning my trade in the district court in the mid-70s. Another figure was Tommy Connolly, SC, credited by many contemporaries with being the founder of modern Irish constitutional law. He was also a famously convivial man, able to rival O'Nolan himself in bibulous episodes, and that is not a compliment lightly given. He acted as a sort of attorney general to O'Nolan throughout his life and was a participant in many of the livelier adventures that he had. For instance, he advised O'Nolan about disputes with the civil service about arrears of expenses, which he did not take lightly. About the circumstances in which he later achieved early retirement from the civil service, at, I suppose, about the age of 40. And he had some difficulty there because the civil service medical officer rejected his medical certificates, which were, of course, provided by gentlemen he'd met in public houses rather than in surgeries. And Mr. Connolly had to advise on the medical officer's alleged lack of power to stigmatise the applicant's choice of doctor. But no doubt Connolly kept O'Nolan supplied with courtroom anecdotes. Now, from the time of his first appearance in the LNH onwards, O'Nolan was a drinker of heroic proportions. Since he lived in Black Rock, and since he commuted by car, not when he was a student, but when he was a civil servant, this led to many a clash with the forces of law and order. In particular, it led to a long-running feud with the Gardaí in Black Rock Station. Connolly was O'Nolan's passenger one evening in the early 50s, when O'Nolan was arrested for drunken driving and taken to Donnybrook Garda Station. A doctor was sent for to carry out the normal tests, which would have been quite familiar to O'Nolan. Connolly at first waited with O'Nolan in the day room, but then, acting on an inspiration which occurred to him, he crossed the road to Long's public house, where he purchased a bottle of whisky. He brought this back to the Garda station, and in full view of the station sergeant, he gave it to O'Nolan, who drank almost all of it, witnessed by the impeccable station sergeant. "Now," said O'Nolan to the station sergeant, "you can get all the doctors you want." When the case came to court, his solicitor took the obvious point that the doctor's testimony was useless, since there was Garda evidence that he had drunk the best part of a bottle of whisky immediately before it. The case was dismissed, but, according to Anthony Cronin, the ploy widely and its success, word of it spread widely amongst drinkers of the time, and they took to carrying naggins with them in case of a similar confrontation. Many years later, the ingenuity of the parliamentary draftsman, whose business it is, usually after an interval of 10 or 15 years, to close off loopholes which legal ingenuity have discovered, they enacted a section which led to the creation of an offence, which I think I can remember from my drunk driving days, that's to say my professional drunk driving days, an offence of doing an act, including the consumption of alcohol, but not including driving or attempting to drive, with intent to frustrate a prosecution for drunken driving. That would have been about 1973, but by then O'Nolan had gone to the great big bona fide in the sky. Now, I should say that a bona fide in those days meant a public house which was allowed to stay open during non-licensed hours in order to facilitate people who are bona fide travellers. They were meant to be on a journey of at least 3 miles. Many of them were on the outskirts of the city, very conveniently for O'Nolan, in places such as Black Rock, Goatstown, Milltown, Dundrum and so on. The case I've just described led to the Gardaí paying particular attention to O'Nolan's not very competent attempts to drive a motor car. The writer resented this extraordinarily. One day, accompanied by a friend of impeccable reputation procured for the purpose, he went to a famous bona fide in Goatstown, which many of you will probably know. The friend, in the presence of equally respectable witnesses, took O'Nolan's car keys from him and then immobilised the vehicle by the removal of the distributor cap. After several drinks, O'Nolan staggered out of the car, got into it, but then appeared to have decided that he needed another drink or two before going home, so he left the car and went back into the pub. He repeated this on multiple occasions until the Gardaí took notice. They arrested him for being drunk in charge of a mechanically propelled vehicle. But then, as now, a mechanically propelled vehicle is defined, you'll be shocked to hear, as a vehicle capable of being propelled mechanically. This one manifestly wasn't, so our friend walked again. It must be recorded, however, that some years later, when he lived in Merrion Avenue, he was eventually convicted of drunken driving. Now, no doubt these involuntary appearances in the district court suggested to him the repeated stories of that tribunal that appeared in his column and that are collected under the heading The District Court in the Best of Miles. I don't know what precisely led to the creation by O'Nolan of a fictional court of his own devising, the Cruiskeen Court of Involuntary Jurisdiction. This was presided over by Justice Twinfeet, and the principal attraction, I think he was, that was to make the point that he walked on 2 feet rather than 4. The principal attraction of the column consisted of the justice's heavy-footed but persistent attempts at humour and his ludicrous attempts at what he thought was proper legal language, combined with the egregious flattery that the advocates before him tendered to him. The origins of the court was described in the column as follows. Owing to pressure of work in the courts of justice, withdrawal of judges and electric heaters, the rise in bicycle crime and other matters, the public-spirited Miles Na Gcopaleen Central Research Bureau has persuaded impatient litigants to bring their differences, instead of to the courts, before the Cruiskeen Court of Voluntary Jurisdiction. That body, an example of its a dispensation of justice which, as he says, was rough, not to say ready, was as follows. An action was brought under the Marine Hereditaments Compensation Act 1901 by a man who lived in an old boat which he had positioned on a hill, and he sought damages from another man who had been negligent in the management of a dinghy which was mounted on a trolley and which he was bringing to the railway station, so as to cause the dinghy to collide with the houseboat. The defence was to the latter structure, being rated on the poor rate, could not be a boat, vessel or ship, but that the dinghy, being a land-borne wheeled article, was not a dinghy, but a velocipede. Twin Feet J inquired whether it was submitted that a small paddle steamer was a farm cart, but counsel submitted that inasmuch as a paddle steamer could not be hauled by a horse, mule, pony, jennet, donkey or ass, it was not a farm cart within the meaning of the Farm Carts Act and must therefore be a paddle steamer. Twin Feet J assessed damages of £4 and excused the jury from service for a year on the ground that they had been at sea for 4 days. You may think that Miles was less than wholly respectful in his attitude to the courts, and that, of course, is something we must deprecate, which I'm sure Anthony Cronin would have apologised for if it had occurred to him. The Cavan fire inquiry was probably O'Nolan's most sustained exposure to a legal environment. The inquiry was very brief indeed by modern standards, taking less than a month. But nevertheless, O'Nolan waged a battle for more than 2 years afterwards about the failure of the department to pay him proper expenses for his sojourn in Cavan Town. One can easily imagine the circumstances in which two convivial young men, such as O'Nolan and Tom O'Higgins, who was then a junior counsel, enjoyed each other's company in whatever temperance hotel they had put up in Cavan. Anyway, it was on one of these sober occasions when they concocted the limerick in question, which I think I might share with you if you promised not to attribute it to me. The limerick suggested that the verdict of the Tribunal of Inquiry, which blamed the fire on an electrical fault, although undoubtedly true, mightn't have been the whole story. They wrote, "In Cavan they had a great fire. Joe McCarthy came down to inquire. 'Twould be a big shame if the nuns were to blame, so it had to be blamed on a wire." Now, it cannot be denied, as these and practically all of what I've said demonstrates, that a major theme in O'Nolan's life and his work and in his involvement with the law was drink. Drink, recovering from drink, finding the money to buy drink, combating those who disapproved of drink, and coming to terms with the effect of drink on himself, occupied a very considerable portion of the energy of O'Nolan and his contemporaries. Anthony Cronin chronicles that he did very little creative work in the 1950s, and that he was himself aware that drink was partly responsible for this. Indeed, he contemplated, because by then he had retired very early from the civil service on the dubious medical certificates that I've mentioned already, he contemplated going for a cure either to the Cistercian Abbey at Mount Mellery or alternatively to Tory Island, where he would devote his new sober energies to the composition of a modest novel at a rate of 600 words a day. He believed the novel would be complete in 3 months if he did that. Mount Mellery, of course, was a famous traditional place for a cure, but Tory Island, which is a place where no serious attempt to impose prohibition or even to put down the punching trade had ever been embarked upon, was perhaps more dubious. But the more fundamental question of whether the substitution of sudden sobriety for the consumption of heroic amounts of drink would have hindered or helped his creativity is another matter. Drink seems to me to have been a wellspring of his work as well as an inhibition on it. You may recall that the Cruiskeen Court of Voluntary Jurisdiction was an invention of the Cruiskeen Research Bureau, headed up by Sir Miles Nicopoline, 87, affectionately known as the DA. The Bureau was principally devoted, in those hard times during World War II, to relieving the asperities of war, hereabouts known as the emergency, of course, for the hard-pressed Irish public. One of its innovations was published with to some éclat in the Irish Times a proposal for the marketing of new patent emergency trousers for the plain people of Ireland. This project was described as follows in the Irish Times. These garments, conventional enough in appearance, will be fitted with long eel-like pockets reaching down to the ankles. The pockets will be the exact diameter of a bottle of stout, not by any coincidence, for they are designed to deal with the nuisance of those brown paper Saturday night parcels. It will be possible to stow four stout in each leg. At first, walking in the loaded position will necessarily be rather slow and straight-legged, but practice will tell in the long run, which should be undertaken only after short runs have been mastered. The Bureau solemnly considered the question of what would happen if the bottles of stout were broken due to accidental impact. But the solution was as follows. The pockets are stout-proof, and the beer will lie safely in the bottom until it can be siphoned into a jug or even into a guest's mouth in the privacy of your own home. The final advantage of this invention is described as follows. On a long journey, a small flexible tube may be carried. This can be unobtrusively inserted into the pocket, and then, after the face has been discreetly obscured by the Irish Times or other interesting national newspaper, the nozzle can be put between the lips and an innocent potation indulged in. I had indeed thought to end my remarks by quoting one of Miles's several heartfelt tributes to Bacchus, whether in prose or verse, but they are well known, A Pint of Plain Is Your Only Man, well known almost to the point of being cliched. So I will quote instead a work which came to my attention in looking into Miles's life, one of the works of a somewhat older associate, Dr. Oliver St. John Gogarty. O'Nolan's obituary of Gogarty impressed me by its extreme familiarity and its untypically kind and indeed deferential tones. Gogarty's poem in question was composed one busy morning in the Shelburne Bar, adjacent to where for some years he had his consulting rooms as an ENT surgeon, as a plaque will tell you. It was typed immediately in the manager's office there because those who heard it first were so impressed by it. It is a true boozer's masterpiece, discreet in tone and ingratiatingly entitled The One Before Breakfast. The one before breakfast, alone in the bar, will slide down your neck fast and cure your catarrh. Ere your glass, now with end up, has quite left your jaws, your body will send up a round of applause. Now, Dr. Gogarty, of course, was a medical man, and with a true clinician's eye, he continued as follows. If the dawn is distressful, the morn will get worse, as those who are less full cry drink is a curse, and urge you to chuck it, which I know that you shall, soon as you kick the bucket, me old boozing pal. But before we blame our babyless ancestors, we must reflect, in some cases, that those who are without sin only should throw the first stone, and in others, such as my own, that these were different times, and the asperities of life, as with the Russians today, accounted for a lot of the heavy drinking, which is so wonderfully memorialised in the life and work of Brian O'Neill. Thank you.